Hey, movie fans, Dimitri here for Popcorn Talks Anatomy of the Movie, where today we are going back. It's a throwback Friday. We're going back about 40 years to show where a movie proved that we were not alone, and that is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Hey, movie fans. How's it going, everybody? I am very excited to be here and to talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Yeah, it's a throwback Friday, but the movie was just re-released in theaters, so you had the opportunity to see it on a big screen, which I very much would urge you to do. Because it's just amazing, and I think it's very exciting that we get to talk about it, along with my awesome, wonderful host, Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone. Yes, I'm here.
You know, I talked about you. I was invited. Can you believe I was invited to be a guest on Meet the Movie Press today?
I know. Look at that. Making your way around.
I was extremely excited and honored to have been asked, but I got to talk a little bit about anatomy, and I talked about my wonderful hosts and how they allowed me to sit next to them to talk movies, and I brought you up, and Phil, who unfortunately he was abducted by the mothership.
He was
not so much abducted as
I think he just chose to go. He left when they left.
Yeah, you know? He left. So we're talking Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a movie that's 40 years old, and in my mind, time has gone by so fast. It is as relevant and as a epic, beautiful movie today as it was when it was released in November of 1977. So I can't wait to talk about this movie. Marissa, when was your first encounter with Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Admittedly, because I was not alive when the first one came out. Or like just this one, I think it was the only one. So I wasn't alive when it first came out, so I wasn't around for like the whole big epicness of what this movie came out to be, I guess you can say that. I had watched this movie in parts, like over the years of my life. I don't think I ever really watched it in one sitting together in its entirety until last week when I watched this. And I was like, I can understand why people love it so much. I can understand why it made such an impact on society and just movie going. We'll get into all the technical aspects of the film. It's like, I can understand why this is like an iconic movie now. And but as a viewer, as an adult watching it, I can, and a film major, you know, just like really looking at it, there's some things I can see where people love it, and some things I can see where people didn't.
Okay.
But overall, I really appreciated what Steven Spielberg pulled off 40 years ago.
Do you know which version you watched of the
Phil
movie?
And I watched the director's cut.
Okay.
And it was long.
Yeah, it's about 2 hours and some change.
Yeah, like 2 hours, maybe 20 minutes.
Yeah,
around
somewhere around there. Uh-huh. And it's the definitive, it's the version. Well, since we're talking about versions, we can talk about that. Yeah, it's the third version. It's the version that Steven Spielberg champions. It's the one that he believes is the definitive and the cut that he wishes he was able to put out back in 1977. So why are there three versions of this movie? We're going to get into a lot about the making of this, but it's a very interesting tale because Columbia Pictures and Michael and Julia Phillips, who are big-time producers of the 70s, they had actually just come off of The Sting. And this was going to be Steven Spielberg's next project after Jaws. And it was something that he was working on during Jaws. And because he was a believer of UFOs. He loved that whole thing, but it was also the 70s. I argue that Close Encounters is definitely a movie of its time that couldn't probably most likely wouldn't be made today. Like a studio wouldn't put in because it's a one-shot movie, so to speak, and he never wanted to make a sequel. But so he works on this movie, and they put it together. Columbia Pictures at the time was in financial disarray. In fact, they were very close to bankruptcy. Very close to bankruptcy. They were banking on Close Encounters, and where Spielberg wanted it to release it in 1978, Columbia Pictures had said, we want it out for Christmas of 77. So he was losing a lot of, he was losing time that he thought he was going to have.
Yeah, that's a whole year earlier.
Yeah, it was. He wanted summer of 78. They wanted it winter holiday season of 77. It had to be on the books. So his editing process became a struggle. In fact, he even says, probably the toughest part was editing the last 25 minutes of this movie.
Okay.
So he puts it together. They get the special effects. It gets out into the theaters. And huge. Does really big business for Columbia Pictures. It saves their ass. Okay? But Spielberg...
Like, you're welcome.
Well, yeah. I mean, it really even though he wasn't happy with the cut and the edit, and even some of the special effects, he was like, it made money. And it furthered Spielberg's career. You gotta understand, Spielberg at this time was still under 30 years old.
Wow.
As a film director. And he had already had Sugarland, Sugarland Express, Duel, Jaws, right? Changed everything. And then Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So with that, it made a ton of money, nominated for Academy Awards. Spielberg wanted to go back and finish the movie. So he went back to Columbia and they said, you know, we'll give you the money to finish it and to shoot scenes that you wanted. However, if you're going to do it to get the money, you have to film a scene inside the mothership.
Mm.
Okay. And he didn't want to, but it was a compromise. And they were going to give him the money to finish the movie, and he said, I'll do it. So then came out Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the special edition, which was released theatrically. And the big marketing thing is, see what's inside. You get to follow Roy Neary, goes inside the mothership, and there you go. Well, Spielberg never really liked having to have to do that. He always felt that it's best for the audience to leave it up to their own imagination. And two, as an ending for Roy Neary's story, I personally, as a lover of this movie and a movie lover in general, I just like the fact that he walks up into the light and that's the end of his story.
Yeah.
Right?
So audience interpretation.
Right. It's leave it up to the audience. And then he was able to go back and he took some scenes from the original. He took some scenes out of the special edition, re-edited some things, and he comes up with the director's cut, which is the cut that he now endorses fully. It was on the 35th anniversary of this beautiful Blu-ray set. A new one is coming out very soon to celebrate the 40th, and hence you get the director's cut of the movie. And in each cut, much like Blade Runner, where Ridley Scott has five different versions.
Right.
It's fun to see the progression of the movie. But that, in a nutshell, is the story of why we get three versions of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Which, when you think about it, how many movies get theatrical release for every version?
Three different versions.
Yeah.
I mean, that just is a testament to Spielberg and how much they believed in him. And him as a director, him as a creator.
So yeah. Yeah.
For him.
And you can tell, too, that the marketing people, because that was one of the things. It's like, what's in the ship? So Sony marketing is like, well, if he's going to do it, that's our mark. See what's inside.
Right.
It's the special
edition. And the version that we watched, the director's cut, you don't go into the ship. You only see the platform.
Yep. That whole scene is cut out, but scenes like that cargo vessel in the desert, the catatonic ship is brand new. Was put into the director's cut and special edition and not in the original edition. And the branching of it and what he re-edited is somewhat fascinating. And I believe this new edition on Blu-ray will have a branching sequence, so you can tell. It'll pop up going, hey, this this scene was not originally here, but it came from here and whatnot. So
that's cool.
As a movie historian and lover of that stuff, it's sort of kind of cool for this movie. So, you know, the other thing that's wonderful about this movie on the big screen, practical effects. Practical effects.
Yes. Okay, here's my question. Now, yeah. Well, I have a couple questions for you. Did you see this originally when it first was released?
I did.
You saw it in theaters?
Yep.
Now, watching it as, you know, as an adult, does it suffer from the theory of diminished return, or was it as great as you expected it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I have that in my rundown as a kid and as now. And as a kid, Close Encounters, it managed to scare the bejesus out of me. Okay. Number one, there are some pretty, as an 11-year-old, there are some pretty horrific scenes, like when Barry gets abducted. You don't know what's going on. And that, I think, is part of the magic of Close Encounters. If you're watching it for the first time and you don't know much of the background, are they malevolent? Are they benevolent?
Yeah.
Right? The good or bad? Like, and this isn't a Independence Day kind of a movie, but yet they abduct the little kid, and it's a horrific scene. Nails coming up from the grate.
The whole abducting of the kid, that really bothered me, because I'm like, where the heck are his parents? They're like, oh, okay.
Well, the mother is there. She's a single mother, which is a common trope in Steven Spielberg movies, because his parents got divorced when he was young, so she's a single mom. And that's the other thing, too, that we'll talk about. It really did show families in a realistic way, albeit broken. So we had a single mom with Barry, who loved her son very much. He gets abducted. Quick little trivia. Mm-hmm. So as he's going through the little doggy door, right, the little trap door. So on the other side of that door was the actor, whose name is Corey, I believe. She was the one pulling him through. Right? So if you look closely. Yeah, well, if you look closely and you have it on Blu-ray and you can stop it by frame, there's an arm which you would assume would be an alien arm. It's actually his mom's arm pulling him through. And that's what helped make him go through that door. He also knew what was going to happen in that kitchen. They let the little boy know. They didn't tell Melinda Dillon what was going to happen in the kitchen.
Oh, so her reactions were more authentic.
Real. She was like, and she was literally trying to protect the actor. Like, she thought shit was going to hit him. So when he gets taken out the door, and he sort of caught it was like an in-joke for him. Mm-hmm. He's like, I wanted to tell her. He knew, yeah. Wow. So, but as a kid, there was stuff that was scary. But then the wonder of it all towards the end, and when we see the aliens for the first time, There was just like this fascination, this wonder, like, wow, they're not mean, they're here to visit, they're bringing everything back, and when it goes off back into space to When You Wish Upon a Star, the cue, it was like the first, something else you have to understand too, it's the first of its kind where aliens weren't out to invade us. Okay. Aliens were coming to the sky, and you looked up at the sky, and there was this wonder, and like, wow, is something actually out there? So as a kid who loved science fiction, and Spielberg always called it science speculation, right? Instead of science fiction. He said if you believed, it's science speculation. If you didn't believe, science fiction. But as a kid, it was just all about the wonder and like, wow. Okay, they're nice, that's cool, and how they communicate with one another. And then when you go on to see E.T., you can see how Close Encounters is like a prequel.
Like, really affected the family aspect, an emotional aspect of aliens. They're not as scary as people make it out to believe, because it's more so the people fear the unknown, and people aren't very informed in the alien and extraterrestrial life. So I can understand where the themes of, oh, it's an alien, they're going to play it up as a mystery or as a thriller, and the scary aspect of it. And I think Spielberg does a great job of showing like the lighter, more positive side of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also have to remember, too, that what I say, Close Encounters is born of its time because his idea was he believed in UFOs heavily as a younger director, right? And a writer. But also, it was a cover-up. Like, the world, the United States specifically, was coming off of Watergate, okay? Yeah. One of the biggest government cover-ups, okay? And at the same time, there was a huge UFO craze, which many people believed was covered up by the government. Area 51, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
There's a reference to Bigfoot in this, right? Mm-hmm. Bigfoot was also a huge craze. Bigfoot made an appearance, a couple of appearances, in The $6 Million Man, which was a huge show in the 70s as well with Lee Majors. And so all of these aspects of government cover-up, UFOs, people wanted to, you know, believe in certain things. This is what Close Encounters, like, came out of. This is where it was born from. So watching it as an adult now and knowing and watching and having watched the movie many times, various versions many times, but seeing it on the big screen, for me, again, I still had that wonder and fantastic, like, beauty of it, but it was little things that I noticed that you can't catch on your television screen unless your television screen is an IMAX type screen. For example, air traffic control scene. When we come out of the desert and it wipes into the air traffic control, the first thing you see is that green radar. That green radar, like, covered the whole screen from floor to ceiling. And I was like, whoa, I forget that as a kid. Mm-hmm. And since all the times I've watched it on TV, you don't realize. He fills up the whole screen. And much like Ridley Scott did in Alien with little beeps and building suspense,
right,
of the alien coming after Dallas. Well, he does the same thing here where he uses little beeps of the airplanes and this unidentified flying object flies by. Real air traffic controllers, by the way, is in that scene.
Authenticity.
Yeah, it was things like that I noticed, and the sound mix. You know, I saw it in like a Dolby Atmos kind of...
You were younger?
Well,
or
just now. Just like, okay, ships recently flying by. It was literally the abduction scene. The scene where...
We'll talk about more of that.
But I'm just going, like, these are the things that I noticed as an adult that just made me love this movie even more. And I had forgotten about the family aspect, the way that plays on the screen. And one of the reasons why is, like, they wouldn't make this movie today because that family is broken, the Neary family.
Yeah.
And it's shown in such a realistic way that that scene was uncomfortable when he's in the bathtub. I don't know if you felt that way. I felt that way with, you know, Ronnie yelling at him, the sun in the opening closing door, and the way that it was edited.
That scene was difficult to watch because we see the disintegration of his character. And then it switches. There's a whole emotional upheaval. It switches over to the woman who's now angry and yelling. Because we see the man, he's broken down. And he's just, like, losing it. And then it switches to the woman who's now angry. It's like polar opposites fighting against each other in the scene.
Right.
It was difficult to watch as a family, yeah, breaking apart. But I didn't understand, or more so, like, I was trying to figure out who are we supposed to be feeling for right now? Are we supposed to be feeling for him or for her?
Right.
And I was just kind of torn, and there was a conflict just watching it.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes that scene real. Like, it makes it as realistic as most anything that I've seen family related wise in a movie, because it didn't pull its punches. You know, it had the kid was screaming, like, crybaby, crybaby. And all the meantime, too, you had the editing with the door opening and closing. And you would edit, you'd see him pointing. And then it'd go back to the bathtub. You'd see Terry Garr, fantastic performance, by the way. And she was, like, screaming, and he's in a bathtub. He's breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very tough scene that you don't see in tentpole commercial movies, which at the time, that's what Close Encounters was. It was a commercial meant to be a big blockbuster success. And all the while, it still has, well, today with the cynicism, there's still cynicism today and the cover-ups and evil lives to strike back, but movie-going audiences are still able to leave the theater feeling good, as they were back in 1977. Mm-hmm. So, and it's one of those movies, too, where I always argue that with the beginning of Jaws, you have movies like Jaws, Star Wars, which also came out in 77.
Yep.
Close Encounters, Raiders of the Lost Ark. They changed the whole way in which movies can be entertaining. There was still a hint of cynicism in those movies. The cover-up of the government at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, because it ends up in that warehouse, right?
Yeah.
In Star Wars, Darth Vader lives. The Empire Strikes Back. Obviously, in this movie, government cover-up. But yet, they were still entertaining movies, and audiences started to feel good about going to the movies because the movies didn't necessarily end on a down note. You know, there wasn't the cynicism. There wasn't so much of the backlash. We were getting out of that Vietnam War era Watergate. And when we went into the 80s, it really was about packaging and making entertainment and fun movies so that people can go and laugh and have a good time. And Close Encounters, I think, is a part of that set of the 70s that helped change the way movie audiences looked at movies. And they were striving for it. Hence, the movies that I talked about became huge. They also were very good movies.
Yeah, successful on their own. You want to talk a little bit about the writing? Steven Spielberg, not really known for his writing, but he does it. But he got sole credit for writing the script. But it was also assisted by Paul Schrader, John Hill, David Giler. Hal Barwood, Matthew Robbins, and Jerry Benson, who all contributed to the screenplay in different aspects of it. But it was really Spielberg who penned
this. It was his idea, yep. Yeah, it was. This was his baby, and it was something that he was thinking about while making Jaws. And before, how can I make this movie? But first, he had to get out of making Jaws. He had to get out alive because he almost had a mental breakdown during Jaws. And it was, what do I do? And he even says, had I not done Jaws first, this movie would have been the hardest movie I've ever did. He goes, but being that I did Jaws before this, this movie was easy.
Yeah.
He's like, this movie was like,
piece of cake.
Come on, terra firma. I don't have cast and crew throwing up a seasickness. I'm not pitching to the right. I don't have props
drowning in the ocean. You
know? Yeah, so he just claims, he goes, Close Encounters was a much better movie going, a movie experience for him to make. And I really think that it set him apart too, because you know, he got one of his icons, Francois Truffaut, in this movie.
Yeah, Truffaut, who is an amazing director in and of himself. An actor. And I personally know him more for his directing.
Right.
But for an actor, because I'm watching this, I was like, that has to be Truffaut, because I don't really recognize him like physically as an actor. But I remember watching it and thinking to myself, it's like, that has to be Truffaut. He's the only French man.
Yeah, and
it has to be him.
Again, as an 11-year-old, I didn't know who the hell he was. As 11 years old, give me a break. but it wasn't until later on that you realize what a big deal it is. In fact, it was the first and only time he was in a movie as an actor where he didn't direct himself, and it was in the States. And he liked the script. So he came on board.
Yeah, I think that's great because it also shows the international demographics for this film, because he was a great director around that same time too. So it added more credibility to the European countries as well to watch this.
Yeah, and let me see if you agree too. His presence in the film is one of, like, he's a sympathetic character because he understands the plight of Roy Neary and like Melinda Dillon and all the 12 people that are pulled to go to Devil's Mountain, as he's the head of this UFO project, and he believes, and it's trying to convince military people and such, and he sticks up for those people. And And he does it in a way, it's like the sympathetic way. It's the way he speaks. It's his look. It's that character's demeanor. I don't think anybody could have played it as well other than him.
That's true. I thought it was a really great performance because it showed that he's just another man just searching for answers.
Yes.
It's not out of malevolence or anything like that. And I like the fact that he was kind of questioning the government, not in a mean way or malicious way. It was more like he was just searching for answers. And he was asking all different types of people.
Right.
I felt like he was just the voice of the audience trying to get the answers, yeah, too.
Yeah, and he was just so good, and I could watch this movie over and over, and I'll key in on certain parts of his performance, but I always loved when he says, "What are you here for? What are you looking for?" And then he goes, "I envy you, Mr. Nitty," you know, and you could tell, like, he did. And I was like, why couldn't he get to go up right into the ship? But it's not that character's story. But he's fantastic.
He's mostly the reason why he brought everyone together. He's kind of like the through line with everybody, the thread that gets everybody literally in one location. So he's that guy.
Yeah, he's that guy, and he's fantastic at it. We can talk. Let's talk casting, too, because Richard Dreyfuss. Okay.
Yeah.
Spielberg tells Dreyfuss about the movie while they're doing Jaws.
Yep.
Yeah, and Spielberg, and Dreyfuss immediately says, he's like thinking, I'm Roy Neary. He goes, I'm Roy Neary. And he starts talking to him about it, and he starts giving him ideas for it. And all the while, Spielberg's going, oh, you know, I'm going after Steve McQueen, which I have a funny Steve McQueen. Oh, I'm going after Al Pacino. I'm going after Dustin Hoffman. And Richard Dreyfuss is like, no. No, oh, he's no, he's not going to do it. He's too much of a no. He's too much of a no. And he finally said to him, he goes, "You can't go with Dustin Hoffman or Al Pacino." He's like, "None of them are childlike. Yeah. None of them can be a kid." And Spielberg looked at him and said, "You got the job."
Right. I think that's good campaigning on his part because Dreyfuss himself says, "I launched myself into a campaign to get the part. I would walk by Steve's office and say stuff like, Al Pacino has no sense of humor.
Right.
Or Jack Nicholson is too crazy. I eventually convinced him to cast me." So that's what So, like, yeah, sometimes you have to, like, plant those seeds. Like, no, they're not good
enough. Who's putting them down? I love that. I love that.
But, like, to prove that he might be better at that
part. Right.
I was like, that's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny, too. And I also found it amazing that actually Steve McQueen was Spielberg's first choice.
Yeah.
And he sent him the script, and Steve McQueen called him back and said, "I love your script. Let's talk." He goes, "I want to talk to you about this." And he goes, "Let's meet at a bar." Now, according to Steven Spielberg, he claims that it's the very, very first ever time he was in a bar, because he wasn't a big drinker.
Mm.
And he said he nursed one beer while McQueen was like knocking beers back, right? And he said he was so cool. In fact, he said Steve McQueen at this bar even broke up a fight. So we got to see Steve McQueen in
fisticuffs. That just shows how often he goes to bars.
Right. So then he's sitting down, and Steve McQueen says, "I love the script," but he respectfully declines the role. And he goes, and Steven's like, "Well, why?" He goes, "I thought you liked it." He goes, "I do." He goes, "But at the end, you have this scene. I can't." He goes, "I don't know why. I can't cry on camera." It was real, like, "I can't, it's not that I'm too cool to do it. I've never been able to cry on camera." And Spielberg was like, "Well, I'll change, I'll rewrite it." He goes, "You can't rewrite that scene. That scene is the heart of the movie." He goes, "When I read that scene on the script, when I was reading the script, I almost cried. I could cry reading the script, but when you say action, that's my hang up.
Yeah.
Well, he understood. They remain friends. After that, Steve McQueen said he did a great script and everything, and hence his quest continued, but he came across Richard Dreyfuss, who was fantastic as Roy Neary.
I think he did a great job because he, I think Roy was just shows like he's that everyday man. He's a family man. He's a that relatable guy that all this is happening to him, and he doesn't know how to do it. But you're rooting for him throughout the whole film, and like you can see the parts where he's frustrated. He can't like he himself can't explain what he just witnessed or what he feels or what's happening to him afterwards. But like you're watching him throughout this entire journey, try to find the same answers that he's searching for. And I really thought he had a lot of shining moments that we'll definitely talk about.
Yeah, absolutely, he did. And, you know, it's just, again, for as an actor coming off of Jaws and then working on this movie, and then he worked again with Spielberg in Always. He actually worked with Terry Garr again in a great, I'll have to look it up on IMDb, a great horse racing movie. It's a comedy. And Terry Garr was in it, who played his wife, girlfriend. And they're, again, their chemistry, I think, is really good together. But, again, coming off of Jaws, coming into Close Encounters, he was just two different characters, and each character is phenomenal. And you're right, the way he grapples with, he, too, has this wonder of it all, but at the same time, he's so tortured because why? Why am I drawn to? What am I drawn to? I can't figure this out. But the important line is, this means something. This is important. This means something. Why am I here?
Right.
And that, too, is part of that quest in Close Encounters.
I think the most funniest part about his character was when, like, he was kind of sunburned because of the temperature completely shifted and only like it affected half of his body. And I think one of the funniest lines in this film was when the sun was like, "You look like a 50-50 bar."
You look like a 50.
I lost it. It was hysterical. The best line.
It's a great. See, it's funny.
I was like, that is brilliant.
my
the, still makes me.
To laugh. Me, the funniest line in that movie, and the 50-50 bar is great. is when he's in at the base of Devil's Tower, and he's being interviewed. He's being interrogated. Let's face it. Mm-hmm. And Francois Truffaut shows him a picture of Devil's Tower. He goes, "Do you recognize this?" He goes, "Yeah, I got one just like it in my living room." I always just love that because that sarcasm was like, "What am I doing here?"
Obviously.
Like, so you look like a 50-50 bar. It's but hysterical. The way he played that too, you know, is again, it wasn't like out of fear. It was like, what is this? I saw something. You know, and when his kids slap him on the ass as he's brushing his teeth to take the picture of his half and half face. Like that again is prime Richard Dreyfuss. And then obviously he goes on to movies like the Goodbye Girl, which he's fantastic in. Right. I mean he's
phenomenal.
Great in that movie.
That's
and,
great movie.
Yeah, yeah. So he's had plenty of roles, but he got to cut his teeth with Steven Spielberg and some of his biggest, Jaws, which redefined movie going. And
Jaws to be followed up with Close Encounters.
Close Encounters? Boy, tough.
I know.
Mr. Dreyfuss. But good job, good job.
Good for him.
So, you know, and then when you have, the hardest part, I guess, was hiring, Jillian was hiring Melinda Dillon. They didn't hire that woman until like a week before she was supposed to start.
That's really late into production.
Extremely late into production, and she really had no idea what was really going on. And she's thrust, and I believe she even got a nomination out of it. She was really good as the single mother grappling with her son's abduction, mm-hmm. and then trying to figure out, why am I being drawn here? So I've got this, my son, who... The other fascinating thing about the movie, the son had the tones, the five tones down, where she had the mountain. She had Devil's Tower.
And that was so we're talking about Devil's Tower. That was the thing that, like, watching it questioned me, and I think that's just how editing has so much evolved in the last 40 years, because we see Roy and Jillian, they're, like, throughout the whole film, they keep building the structure, the Devil's Tower structure. And they keep saying, dropping lines like, I'm envisioning this. This is what I'm seeing. And as the audience, just watching him, like, where is this image come from? Right. Because I think with modern day editing, you can see, like, you can have those inserts of, like, flashes or, like, any dreams or something that's, like, actually affecting them that the audience can also see what they're saying. But they just drop the line that they're seeing it, and we yet have not seen it at all visually.
Well, but they too don't know that it's Devil's Tower. Like, yeah. And I think by doing that, it really takes away from the mystery, because he's seeing this in mashed potatoes. He's seeing this
in garbage.
He's seeing this, like, all over the place, and he's seeing it in his shaving cream. And he's asking people, like, what does this look like to you? Like, what? And there's a piece that's missing. And so as he's crafting it, whether it's in mashed potatoes or not, and then at the end, well, when he sort of breaks.
Chop off the top.
Well, and he has the breakdown and uses his kitchen and living room. Even then, he's not getting it right. And neither is Melinda Dillon's character.
Jillian.
They're not taking the top off, so to speak, mm-hmm. to make it look that way. And as an audience member, you're going, I don't even know what that looks like. I don't know. And then when you see it on TV, and again, I'm not sure as an 11-year-old I even knew what the hell Devil's Tower was. But right. when you see that scene with Walter Cronkite talking about the evacuation, and you see... And you look at it, and you're like going, that's what they're looking for. I think the epiphany far outshines, like, having seen what those images would be, because they themselves don't know what it is, and they can't get it right until he sees the TV, or he pulls off the top, and he's like,
and then realizes what it is.
Get a map, and he's always getting lost.
Yeah.
So, but the Devil's Tower aspect, too, was something that they... Joe Owls, who's the production designer, who also worked on Jaws, and I believe he went on to direct the wonderful Jaws 3 in 3D, but he was scouring the country looking for a landmark, and Spielberg was like, well, do we use Monument Valley? What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And when Joe Owls found Devil's Tower, he was like, this is perfect. He goes, this is great,
And it makes sense. It was like a location within America, because right now the situation was like the characters that we were following, they were in America. Yeah, we had Truffaut's character who like kind of represented the rest of the world, but it made sense that it all came to this one point in America.
Yeah, you know, and it became iconic. You know, because it of did. It, really, it was used in the it's advertising.
And then every poster that you see for Close Encounters.
Yep. And so, and I got one just like it in my living room. So,
hopefully, you know, not made out of garbage.
No. And mud. Carrie Guffey, who played Barry, was 3 years old at the time, 3 going on to 4. He was found in like a school play, and his niece. Or whatever found him, and it was down to he and another actor, child. And Spielberg was like, Carrie's the one. He's the child. And, you know, and it goes to Spielberg. You know, how many times have we talked about kids in movies, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't like to pick on bad performances by a kid in a movie. I always blame the director because he's a kid.
Right.
Like this.
But in fairness, there are kids who are great at acting and can break your hearts no matter what.
They can. Well, and they will have a gift, but I also say too that the director has to coax it out of them, and much like he did with little Carrie Duffy, who earned the nickname One Take Carrie, because every scene he filmed, they did in one take. Now, Spielberg manipulated him in certain ways. But it's sort of funny because the scene where the aliens first come into the house and Carrie comes downstairs, he sees the refrigerator, all of the mess is all outside. Well, Spielberg had two almost like boxes. And so Carrie looks up and they lift up one of the boxes and there was somebody dressed up as a clown. And he was like, that gets a smile on his face. And then they lift the other box up, and it was a person in a gorilla suit. And that's why he stopped and stepped back. And then when they started his story, the guy took off his mask, mm-hmm. and he saw that it was one of the crew that he got along with, and then he smiles again. That's the genius of Spielberg in getting a three-year-old to act and to react.
Smile. Yeah.
And the wonderful scene where the little boy says, "Toys!" Spielberg had a box.
Oh, all those toys, man.
Well, he had a Christmas gift box. Mm-hmm. And while the scene's going on, he started to slowly unwrap it. Slowly unwrap it. And what did it unearth? But toys. So that's why he goes, "Toys!" And you go, that's how Spielberg works with kids. There's a wonderful behind-the-scenes photograph of little Carrie looking through the camera. And he's got that wonder of a child, like, "Oh my God, this is so cool." He's 3-4-year-old boy. That's how Spielberg got to work with kids. Look at the kids' performance between Henry Thomas, Drew Barrymore, and E.T.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Even the kids that were in Jaws, you know, how he works with them. He understands them. Mm-hmm. And if he wants to perform, he knows how to coax that performance out of them.
And yeah, I think it's in real time. Reveal like that, that's, you know, that shows the creativity he right. has yeah. to get a real-time reaction.
Yeah.
So I mean, and like, no one would really think that, but Spielberg did.
He does.
That's
yeah.
why he's a genius.
And remember the mashed potato scene I mentioned? I don't know if you caught the line where the little girl goes, "There's a dead fly in my mashed potatoes." Well, there was actually a dead fly in the girl's mashed potatoes. And so they kept going, but they're all trying not to laugh because that wasn't scripted. Mm. She's just like, "Oh, there's a dead fly in my mashed potatoes." And they were very hard trying not to laugh.
I think that's bad luck.
To me, that's hysterical.
Flies in champagne is bad luck.
Kids will say
the darnest things.
The darnest yep. things.
Interesting.
So,
interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's really cool. And I think Spielberg did a great job with the acting, or with all, directing all the actors and getting the whatever performances he need out of all of them, let alone having the visual creativity already of what he was envisioning on screen.
Which is amazing. Because he also gets, I don't know if you paid attention to the credits at the end, he also gets a credit for visual concept
yeah.
of the movie. So he had an idea as to what a lot of the spaceships were going to, what he thought they should look like.
Yeah, well, let's get into the production
sure.
aspect of it and, yeah. and the look.
Yeah, I mean, for example, let's talk about the mothership. His original concept of the mothership is that it would just be all black. And then it was going to be like almost like a black hole in the sky. And when they were in India filming the scene where everybody
points
up, which again, I cannot stress enough, folks, try to see this on the big screen, because that scene with the way that it's shot with the man up on, it's a, like, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, this is Richard Attenborough kind of thing.
Epic.
And then they go, like, "Where was it from?" And all the fingers point up. And it's just the way that the camera is, it's fantastic. But when they're in India filming that, he found this industrial plant. And, you know, smokestacks, whatever. And he's like, "Huh, well, that's a really great concept. What if I can have that?" And then he based the bottom off of the San Fernando lights at nighttime. That's the valley.
Yeah.
So for you people in California, whenever you're looking at the San Fernando, if you're ever up in Universal and you get to look out at the San Fernando,
yeah,
that's the bottom of the ship. And when you...
Yeah, or if you're heading south on the 4.
Right,
4 or 5. You can see the... At night, you yeah. can see the whole valley in lights.
You can see the bottom of the mothership.
It's pretty cool.
That's it. And I'm like...
That's pretty brilliant.
That's... Yeah. And then, but getting that vision onto the mothership with the lights being what they are, and getting Douglas Trumbull and getting the special effects team involved. All in all, when all was said and done, that thing weighed 200 pounds. Mm. Weighed 200 pounds.
Wow.
To move it was no small task.
I can imagine. I mean, and I liked the different looks of, because when we, throughout the whole movie, when we see the lights and stuff.
Yes.
It's not like a very nefarious type of light. It's just like, what is this flying towards me?
Right.
And I liked it. It gave it kind of a mystical aspect, but not really a scary aspect. Mm-hmm. They were pretty lights. They were blue and pink and purple. You're like
ice cream.
Those are colors. Yeah, those are colors you're not afraid of. If it was red or yellow, mm-hmm. that kind of gives off that danger type of warning. Just like the symbolism of color. Right. And I think that was another visual sign of why these aliens aren't as scary as you think they would be, considering their colors are pink. I mean, come on.
Right. And Spielberg, to your credit, to your point, one of his favorite scenes in the movie is when Barry opens up the door and you see that orange light going by, but it was like three lights. Mm-hmm. And he's like, to me, that's my favorite scene. He goes, because the kids are drawn to the light. And here's this beautiful, like this colorful light. We're scared as an adult. But he's an innocent kid.
Kids don't know.
And the other thing, when you think about lighting and lights, right? Mm-hmm. What does Spielberg do? He sets up he sets up a scene where Roy Neary is lost. It's at the beginning of the movie. And he's off to the side of the road, and he has his map, and headlights come up behind him. And he waves the guy around. The guy goes around him, and the guy's like, you're in the middle of the road. And he goes, all right, turkey, and drives off. Drives a little more, stops again, and we see headlights coming up. It's like it's another car, and he waves him off, but instead of going around, those lights go up.
Yeah, no, I like that.
So he uses familiarity of lights, something that we're familiar with, but he has him do something else. He has him levitate.
They're like, oh, something is behind him.
Such an amazing scene that leads to that whole scene inside his truck, which they used on a dancing on the ceiling, Fred Astaire kind of, they lock a camera down.
Movie.
Yeah.
So and good.
That's how they, just a simple practical effect.
Mm-hmm.
And on screen, and on the big screen with the sound, it's just, you go, well, what kind of special effects did they do that? Oh, well, now Fred Astaire was doing it. He was dancing, you know, and so did Lionel Richie.
And tap shoes.
Yeah. All right. So that's like, that is the wherewithal of those practical effects. And then you hire on people like Douglas Trumbull, who was a genius at doing special effects and lighting. He went on to do things like Blade Runner. And if you notice Blade Runner, the spinner cars, their lighting and the lens flaring.
It's like that whole film like is just the scene itself, or like the whole city itself is just pure lights.
Yeah, and when you think, he even uses a sound drop. Like there's a scene where a ship flies by, it's beautiful, big lens flare. Who else uses lens flare a lot?
J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams. Who did J.J. Abrams work for? And then
Spielberg,
and he did Super 8. And if you watch Super 8, and I urge you to do this after watching Close Encounters.
Who he also produced.
Yeah, and he lifts a lot of scenes from Close Encounters and puts them in Super 8, which is sort of, you know, it's how they work together. But it's
not part enjoyed of the Super 8, too.
Me, too.
I feel like a lot of people enjoy that film. And you can kind of definitely see the similar themes and where he got his
absolutely.
Creativity from that.
But going back to Douglas Trumbull, another thing that he had done that we've seen in movies since, especially in the 80s, the cloud sequence.
Oh,
they were basically squirting white paint into water and filming it and going around. That effect can be also seen in like Raiders of the Lost Ark, in the movie Poltergeist, where the clouds are coming around. They didn't know what the hell they were doing. And like coming up with that is really something quite amazing. And as a practical effect, to me anyways, it just doesn't get old. Like, you see this on the big screen, and there's nothing that I can point to. It's not like watching a movie, an alien invasion movie, say, in the 50s, with flying saucers, where you can sort of see the string. Or you know that the camera was locked down, and they're, like, bringing the things by. This was very fluid. The way the ships moved and tumbled and turned, and the choreography used for the ships. They each had their own character, including the little red Tinkerbell Dot.
Yeah, and even with the music too, which we'll definitely get to.
We have to.
Yeah. But I love to talk about the abduction scene, because I think this was by far, me personally, one of the best scenes, if not in my personal opinion, the best scene in the film. I think just from a filmmaking standpoint, mm-hmm. it is so solid all around. The acting, the lighting, the editing, the sound design, the sound mixing, the cinematography. Like, literally, this, just isolate the scene. Yeah. It is so good, and it's one of the reasons why this movie is iconic.
Yeah, and it's a terrifying scene.
It's horrifying.
And it showed things that, again, as a movie-going audience, to show screws unscrewing themselves, like going up. Number one, how do they do that? Because you're not thinking, and coupled with the sound editing, coupled with the music,
the lighting
and the smoke,
when she would open curtains and stuff, and it was just bright lights right at her.
Yeah,
you can't see what's happening.
Yeah, the world's first Roomba vacuum. Right. Then I go, hey, it's the first Roomba. Hey, That sound effect. How about the oven and the stove and the red?
Yeah.
The red hot, and then it opens up. And
talking about color symbolism, it's like that scene was red and orange. Those are warning colors that that danger is upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was so good because for as long as that scene is, I mean, it's a good solid, like, what, 5-7 minutes sequence.
Yeah.
You watch her move from room to room throughout that entire house, and she has literally nowhere to go. And I think you could see that slow progression of her, like, really starting off just okay, but now, like, completely terrified and
shutting the windows and
useless throughout the whole
film. Yeah, it's a very terrifying scene. As an 11-year-old, it literally did scare the bejesus out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And a little boy gets abducted. Like, it's that's horror. She gets kidnapped by the aliens, and at that point you're going, these people aren't good. These people aren't good, and if
why
it wasn't
are you stealing children?
Right. And when you see a Francois Truffaut's character who's sort of kind of sticking up for him, he wants to know why, but you go, they stole a kid! They took a kid from his mother, and they did it in such a horrific way. Vacuums are just turning on and running around. Right. We got screws coming up. Oh, the scene from the fireplace? And she's, like, trying to grab and shut the thing? Yeah. Like, you
and
don't
I,
know?
I love that shot because you see the camera actually moving down the chimney, and you know that something is actually after her.
Yeah, and, I have to say, like, too, if you were able, look, if it's still out near you in a theater and you haven't seen it, you gotta go because they do something pretty special. They have a 10-minute featurette prior to the movie, and in that featurette, they show behind-the-scenes clips, like Steven Spielberg's home movies of that scene. So you actually get to see the floor and the men underneath the floor that they built, unscrewing the screws, and Spielberg watching through his camera going, cut, that's perfect, that's great, that's what I wanted. And then when they're doing the fireplace scene, you see him and they're like dropping the camera down, and then they have people on the sides throwing
whatever.
Filament or whatever, like dust and whatever coming down, and he goes, all right, stop the camera there. He goes, all right. Action again, and then the camera goes farther down. I want to see the hand. And then to watch the movie, you go, wow. Like, again, 77 practical effects at their best, and it's artists working together to construct one of the most thrilling scenes of movies of that time, the way it was edited and the sound. And then when he finally gets taken away, everything sort of kind of quiets down and stops, and she comes running out.
Outside, and you see it all just like, it's like a big storm that just like moved past the house, and you're just chasing it.
Yeah.
And she literally can't catch it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when a thunderstorm rolls in, it's scary for like when it's right at the location, but then eventually moves on.
And she's watching this recede, and she's watching the lights in the clouds.
Go away.
And yeah. Yeah, it's... The way that scene begins, that scene alone has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's
It's like so if great. You don't, for whatever reason, you don't want to watch this movie, just watch this scene, and it'll convince you otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, this is one of the best scenes in just film history.
Yeah,
in and of itself,
and it shows to Spielberg's genius of constructing a major action type of sequence and doing it in a way that's both artful, entertaining, and thrilling, and very, very scary. If you're an 11-year-old kid and now is older, you get to watch it, you get to marvel at, wow, pretty cool, and how it's claustrophobic, and then it ends in the big vista because she's out in the far, you know, she's out in the sticks where they live in Muncie in Indiana. Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful scene. Is there another scene you wanted to talk about, or?
Well, I mean, we could talk about the actual ending, the last 20-minute sequence scene that, like, what it all boils down to, you know, the meat and potatoes of the entire film. When everyone just finally gets to Devil's Tower.
Right.
They, and we could talk about it from the beginning, the whole interaction with music communication. Right. I really enjoyed it. I mean, yeah. Sean Williams is legend.
Yeah, in this... Yeah, we'll talk. Let's talk about his score, because I think it's so integral to this movie. It's as integral as it is in Jaws, and it's very integral here, because over here he's got a flip flop. He's got to switch from the scene, the abduction scene, which is a very horrific scene, right? Mm-hmm. And then he's got to go in the end. You know, and then he's got to do certain sound cues. So he uses "Wish Upon a Star," but he's also coming up with the five tones, which has become so iconic. And this is where, when Williams works with Spielberg, this is where they're genius. You know, Star Wars aside, when you look at, you know, because that was with George Lucas, and it's a very iconic theme, right? You just saw John Williams, right?
I did. Right? Okay, so we were actually supposed to talk about Close Encounters last Friday.
Yeah.
And last
I messed
Friday,
that up, folks. Yeah, it's okay. My apologies.
Last Friday, literally a week ago from today, I saw John Williams perform at the Hollywood Bowl, and it was everything and more that I wanted it to be. It was so great, because I had watched Close Encounters literally the night before, so within probably 20 hours, I watched the movie, and then I saw John Williams live, and they actually, that was the first score that he performed,
was
Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and I heard the five tones. I was like, yep, I know what this is.
Yep.
It's and great. It's so good.
Yeah, and it's an amazing soundtrack. Again, folks, I think you can find this on your iTunes or Spotify. Look up Close Encounters of the Third Kind, an anniversary edition, special edition soundtrack. Not that it's from the special edition version. And it has all the tracks, and they're pretty much in order, and they're in their full length. And it's wonderful to listen to. But the five tones, now I learned something. John Williams wanted seven. Because apparently seven beats, seven tones is a song, okay? Mm-hmm. Four tones is like a fragment.
Four tones is a bar.
Right, and five tones is like in the middle of no man's land. But Spielberg wanted five simple tones. And he also felt, Spielberg, that music is something that everybody can relate to. So why not it be a musical type of tone that people could communicate with, which makes sense when you think about it, because we are very auditory, you know, based. We hear things, and if we hear music, we can, and you can tell from the tone of music. Just take his score.
Right.
He can go from menacing, from Jaws, to adventurous. As like, we're hunting a shark, we're out fishing,
Jaws
this is an adventure.
Jaws in two notes compared to Close Encounters in five. Right. And if you think about it, I can understand why John Williams wanted four or seven.
No, he wanted seven.
Yeah, seven is a song, but four is a chord. You can have four different notes in one chord.
Yeah, and Spielberg was like, no, I want this to be five. And they worked together to try to come up with the five notes. And in fact, they even went as far as to consult with a mathematician. A mathematician said, take all the notes, how many things can we get with five notes? And then it was, I believe it was John Williams who did the bing, 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 bing. Mm-hmm. And then it became iconic. And it's yet another John Williams, like when you hear that, Close Encounters. I mean, yeah. It went so far that it was even referenced in James Bond's Moonraker. Like those five tones were used as a key code to get into a laboratory. So it's gone that, like, that's what John Williams and Steven Spielberg are able to collaborate with. And the music at the end, also the whole communication when they say, okay, it's on automatic. and they get away from the synthesizer, the organ.
Yep.
And it's just communicating. Oh, and I got my little light bar here because it was tones and lights.
Oh, there you go. It's a pin.
It's a pin. And I don't. The other thing that was that I noticed. This is the first time I ever noticed this. We are taught, even with music, we read from left to right.
Yeah.
If you noticed in the bars, they went from right to left. Mm-hmm. If you noticed on that, the soundboard, so we'll call it, or the light board, we'll call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the light board.
It went from, yeah, it went from boop, 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 boop. It went right to, which is foreign, like, well, at least to us, because this is the way we're taught to read. And this is an alien form. And I was like, I wonder if that was, because I couldn't find out if that was a conscious decision instead of going left to right to do it right to left. And it was just something that I noticed in the movie because it was in such a big freaking screen.
Yeah. It was awesome. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, the English language is left to right. But, you know, I believe over in Asia, they actually read it right.
Yeah, and they can right go up and left. Down. Yeah, it was exactly. Just interesting.
It's literally backwards.
That's how they're... That's how they were interpreting music or musical mm-hmm. tones. Trivia about that, too. I'm sure you picked it up. But there is theme. There is a theme that John Williams lifted that's on the mothership towards the end.
From Jaws.
Yep, we hear the Jaws theme.
I heard it. It was funny because you had sent Phil and I a message about, like, go right. Look for it. And then I was like, there it is.
Yep.
I
got it. And there were two.
I liked it.
There were two sound lifts from Jaws. That one was the obvious. And I told Phil, too. I said, your mission, should you decide to accept, is there were two film drops. There were two sound drops that Spielberg lifted from Jaws. And he put into the movie. One of them is obvious, and that's the one. Did you... Well, you have to be...
I only noticed it at the end.
Idiot like me. The other sound drop, and it's not a musical cue, but it is a literal sound drop.
Was it when he was actually playing the piano?
No.
Okay. Because that's where I thought he played, when the kid was just like slamming keys on the piano.
No, it's the scene, I call it the Lawrence of Arabia train scene, when Roy, they come up and the train and people are being evacuated onto the train and there's a lot of chaos and Roy's looking for, I always forget her name. Melinda Dillon's character and Jillian, and they're separated by the horde of people who are trying to get onto the train. There is a sound in Jaws during the 4th of July, the beach scene, while people are being evacuated out of the water.
Right.
Okay, it was the fake shark. There is a scene where camera is set and a woman is screaming and there's a helicopter going by. You just hear the helicopter, and it's right in that scene. In that, he takes that sound drop, and he puts it into that same sound, and you can hear the woman screaming as well, and it's the helicopter going by. He took that from Jaws.
There you go.
Yeah, and he does that sort of kind of often with his movies, but that's a little cool little... There's some trivia for you if you pay attention to your Jaws and Steven Spielberg movies.
I think the music and the sound was great in this film. If you ever get the chance to see John Williams, do it, because the man is a legend.
Now, did you know that runway scene? So they had the Devil's Tower, and then they had to build this set, which was supposedly behind the Devil's Tower, the runway. At the time, it was the biggest... It was the biggest set built, American set built for a movie.
Handmade.
Well, they were looking for warehouses and things, but they couldn't find anything that could open up, like, that could only be, like, three walls and that they can shoot out from. So, in an Air Force base in Mobile, Alabama, they found a disused hangar that had been used for dirigibles. Blimps.
There you go.
And it fit their needs so that they can build this runway and they could have the open space. And it was 300 feet, I should say. So they can use all of this room and space and film out. But it was a blimp hangar deck. Isn't that cool?
The things
like
you
that.
Learn.
Yeah.
That is pretty neat.
Yeah, so
no one would think that.
Another interesting thing you might want to know about that scene, too. So when the ship, is going back and forth, or they're trying to communicate, and they go, and then the mothership goes, boom, boom. Yeah. The scene where Roy Neary is down and it blows out the glass and the tower thing and the observation thing. Columbia said, we don't, because they needed the candied glass to do it, and they needed about five panes of it, the sugar glass. And Columbia said, we don't have the money for it. He goes, we really don't. We have to cut that out. But Spielberg wanted it so much, he paid for that scene out of pocket. His own money. Because he thought that scene, it just said so much. So I was like, oh, that's cool. He put his own money up. He put his money where his mouth is. They made the candy glass.
That looks great.
And they one shot. Didn't even need it all.
See?
So.
Come on, Columbia. Yeah. Have a little bit more faith in him. All right. That's really great. And so this film was actually a box office success. Knowing that the budget was only like
$20 million.
Spielberg went over a bit with the original budget. But, I mean, it became a financial success.
No, absolutely. And we talked about this on Meet the Movie Press a little bit. What's really fantastic and amazing, domestic lifetime gross is $134 million. Okay. Now, this isn't adjusted. This is the domestic gross, right? But here's the thing that you need to really key in on. Its widest release, at its widest release, it was 650 theaters.
That's not a lot.
Not a lot. That's considered an art house film release in today's market. 650 to pull in 134. Or actually, it was 116, and then with various re-releases and stuff, 134. But to do that kind of business at your widest, 650. I mean, today we're looking at movies that are 4,000 locations.
Right.
This wasn't a time. And this is what, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Like, even movies that are 600-plus theaters, they barely hit million, you know? I mean, like, in today's adjusted
grosses. Yeah, they're not going to.
That's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
So that just shows, like, how successful that film was if you actually, you know, do the math, which I'm not going to. Does it split it up with 600 to get millions of dollars in that aspect?
Yeah, and just think about Jaws itself was the very first movie to broach or to breach 100 million, and that was only released at 500, and that was a ton. So now it goes to 650, and again, yeah, sort of, just to help put some things in perspective, and I know, I'm old, okay, I get it. They weren't doubling these movies up in a theater. You weren't having multiplexes with 15, 20 screens. You were having multiplexes that might have six, maybe eight. Eight was, whoa, I'm going to an eightplex, wow. But they weren't doubling up the prints. So Close Encounters was, Star Wars, it was had one screen. That was it. Hence, that's why they were called blockbusters, because you couldn't get in. It's also, its release pattern, Columbia decided to platform it, which means they went super limited. It only opened up in two locations when it first opened. It opened up at the Cinerama Dome here in Los Angeles, and the Ziegfeld Theater in New York City. The Ziegfeld, which, beautiful theater, by the way, is, it was just, I had the privilege of seeing one of the Star Wars movies at the Ziegfeld, and I've seen many a movie at the Cinerama Dome. There, it was selling out for weeks during weekdays. During weekdays.
Wow.
The movie, and that's when Columbia, and they were building this groundswell, because Spielberg just wanted it to go out, but it was Sony's idea. They said, no, we're going to open it up at 2, and they built up this marketing groundswell, because the word of mouth was so positive on this movie, too, and then when they opened it up, then it started selling out. There's no such thing as a sellout today. Like, if you want to see It, which opens up this weekend, which is supposed to do gangbuster business, if you can't get into the 1 o'clock show, you'll get into the 1:15.
Right. Star Wars might be a sellout compared.
Maybe on like the IMAX screen, but if you want to go to see Star Wars Last Jedi, the odds are you can probably see it opening weekend. You may not be seeing it in the biggest theater, but
you can see it
on your 20-plex. It's going to have 10 screens.
Right.
So think about 650 theaters
locations,
and it doing $116 million.
Well, I mean, and the ratings for this film is still doing great after a course of 40 years. It's still the personal scores and, you know, Rotten Tomato has it at 96, audience 85. I mean, those are huge scores. Mm-hmm.
For a movie that's 40 years old. And again, just being the film buff and lover that I am, for me to see it in the big screen, like, I just felt so good. I was giddy to watch it. You know, one other thing that we can talk about box office, we got to talk about The Bet. The Bet. Do you know about The Bet?
No.
Okay, so Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were friends. They became friends. Mm-hmm. And they had a bet. Spielberg and Lucas, they both had these new movies out in 77. George Lucas had Star Wars. Spielberg had Close Encounters. They each saw other's movies.
Yeah, right.
All right. So Lucas thought, he thought that Star Wars was going to tank. He didn't think it was going to make money.
Little did he know.
And he watched, you know, and he'd seen Jaws, and he had watched Close Encounters. So the bet was, he knew that Lucas felt that Spielberg's Close Encounters would break box office records like Jaws. So he offered Spielberg a friendly wager. Both agreed to give the other 2.5% of the profits of their respective films.
Oh, jeez.
Whoever outgrossed. They said, okay. Lucas grossly underestimated his own movie. Spielberg was like, no way, George, I've seen Star Wars. It's huge. It's going to be huge. Way bigger than Close Encounters. Yep, and you know what? You know what's awesome about the both of them? It's awesome at the same time it's sickening. Because, George Lucas paid up a cool 40 mil.
That's ridiculous.
2.5% of the...
It's like 40 chump mil. Change for him now. But
okay, Steven, here's 40 go. Mil. When are we going
go
to Hawaii?
Go make another Close Encounters film.
Yeah, when are we going to go to Hawaii? You know? But again, it's that kind of thing where I've said lightning in a bottle before. We don't see this kind of camaraderie. We do see Guillermo del Toro, Alfonso Cuarón, and the gentleman who did Revenant.
Iñárritu.
Yeah, and that the three of them actually share their movies with one another and such, which is really cool. But we don't hear much about, you know, we don't know of that they're making bets.
Yeah, like the friendship behind the scenes.
Yeah, which would be sort of kind of cool. But you also have to remember, back in the 70s, like, there was Francis Ford Coppola, right? There was Robert Zemeckis was coming up. I can't think of his name. John Milius, who wrote and directed, like, Red Dawn is what most known for. Lawrence Kasdan, who, like, they worked to write Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, right.
These people hung together because of their passion for movies and their creativeness. You don't get that today. And then Spielberg and George Lucas were in Hawaii when they concocted the idea for Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, and that's how they started to... That's when they collaborated together.
There you go.
And to me, again, it's that type of cinema, because it really did come out of a passion.
From multiple creators.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool to know. I mean, and this film has a legacy for 40 years.
Oh, absolutely.
And, I mean, it received numerous of Academy Awards for the 50th Academy Awards. So they got nominated for 8 Oscars. Best Director, Supporting Actress, Melinda Dillon. Visual Effects, Art Direction, Original Music Score, Film Editing, and Sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And that was a time, too, where people just poo-pooing. The Academy just didn't like Spielberg. Because he changed
the one for cinematography.
Things. Yeah. Well, Vilo Zsigmond, who is a wonderful cinematographer. Actually, this movie, too, had probably, they say, the most cinematographers to ever work on one single movie. But he was the head cinematographer, and what he did was quite amazing, particularly when you look at the lighting, the way scenes shot. You know, one other thing that I think about Close Encounters, outside of the clothing and maybe the cars, but even not so much because station wagons still exist today, It is sort of kind of timeless.
I was behind a station wagon yesterday.
Were you really?
I kid you not.
See?
And it was speeding. It was going faster than my 2015 car. I'm like, this is not
That's
right.
Great. But outside of that, it's still sort of timeless when you think about it. Because I can only recollect one source music cue, and that's Boston's More Than a Feeling, which is slightly heard at the McDonald's at the beginning of the movie. And then, of course, you have When You Wish Upon a Star. So,
but John Williams, I mean, come on, you can't beat him.
No, you can't beat his score. You just can't. And people still, to this day, I mean, Sony is working on a 40th anniversary edition disc, which will even have some more of Steven Spielberg's home movies from behind the scenes. And Spielberg, actually, he champions this movie because it was very personal for him. And if you ever have the opportunity in any of the bonus features to watch him talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I urge you to do it, because he does it with an introspection of maturity. And not many directors will do this, but he talks about how he goes, I couldn't make Close Encounters today.
No.
He goes, I couldn't do it. He goes, I'm a family man. And whatever. He goes, I can't grapple. Like, back then, it made sense for me to have Rainieri get on the ship because he wants to explore. He's seeing what this is. He goes, today I look back and I'm like, number one, I'm a family man. I can't think of a man who would leave his family.
Yeah.
The other thing that he talks a lot about is, when he made the movie, he was a believer. He believed in UFOs, and that was his genesis. And then government cover up from Watergate and whatnot. They actually had a famous UFOologist who has a cameo in the movie. His name was J. Allen Hynek, and he was a disbeliever. He was Mulder to Fox, okay? Mulder was the disbeliever. It's an X-Files thing, and Fox is the believer. He was Mulder. He was a disbeliever, and he was hired by the government, because this was such a big deal at the time, to write a blue book thing about UFOs. He interviewed so many people, he became a believer. He found that there was so much evidence out there, that there was someone out there that we're not allowed. He couldn't deny the facts.
Yep.
And he was also the person who, it's called Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm-hmm.
He developed the barometer of what a third kind is, because there's a Close Encounters of a First Kind.
Yeah, have you, okay, yeah. So.
Go ahead.
While you're explaining this,
yeah.
Have you seen the trailer? If you actually go back and watch the original trailer for this film, it explains this.
It's in the poster, too.
Yeah.
It's in one of the original posters. So you have, there's the sighting. Then there is the physical, whether it's a land depression, magnetic fields, whatever.
Right.
And then there is actual contact.
Yeah, communication.
Yeah, communication. And he was the gentleman that this Allen Hynek, he came up with that barometer for it. He has a cameo in the movie. You may remember, there's a scene, Spielberg loves to do this, crowd. It was towards the end of the film, all the scientists, and one man comes walking up. And he has a pipe,
mm-hmm.
and he has like a beard kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's him.
Got it.
He put him in the movie. Another awesome cameo. Did you pick out Lance Henriksen?
Nope.
Lance Henriksen is in the movie. And like not, he doesn't have a major part, but he's in the movie enough. He's almost unrecognizable because his face is smooth. He's not the Lance Henriksen that we know of today, but I just think that its legacy is going to continue, and you should. It's one of Spielberg's most personal films. The other thing that he talks about too is he's not as much of a believer anymore, and his reasoning makes so much sense. He goes, everybody today has a camera phone. If you would figure with camera phones, we would be seeing more sightings.
Yeah. Right.
He goes, because everybody's got one. He goes, but we don't.
Yeah.
Because we don't see anything. My only argument against that is because We're too busy looking down at our camera phones. We're really not looking up at the sky.
Well, like, I love that board scene, that boardroom scene when the man was showing, he's like, this is a picture of a flying saucer. And like, everyone believes it. It's like, no, this is actually a picture of my kid throwing a pie plate. Yeah, a plate in the yard. Like, yeah, you can take any picture and call it what you want.
Right.
From anybody. And I think that really, that watching that today, knowing how social media is with the, you know, saturation of everybody has ability to take whatever photo or video and manipulate it in whatever way. I was like, this film makes more sense back in the 40 years ago than it would now.
Yeah, and, you know, and again, in that same scene, you had the old man who was on the street when Roy first sees the UFOs and they come by and they duck down, ice cream, and you see the old man,
who's just happened to be there.
In that scene, that boardroom scene, he's like, I saw Bigfoot once. He made a sound that I would not want to hear. And then, like, you just see Roy Nearing going, don't help me. Just don't help me. I'm trying to figure things out here. I got a wife who's going to leave me.
Like, you always have to have that one schmuck there to be the peanut gallery.
Yeah.
And that was him.
Yeah, did you recognize that old man?
He looked very familiar.
He's the old man in Home Alone.
Home Alone.
He's the neighbor. That's him.
That is him.
He's the neighbor in Home Alone.
I was like, I know something that makes sense. Well, that's also a great film, too. Anything else about this film before we wrap it?
You know, we talked about all the various editions, how Spielberg pretty much single-handedly saved Columbia's bacon.
He brought the bacon.
Yeah, he brought the bacon. You know, maybe at some point, like his folly, people would say, would be, I believe his follow-up film was like 1941. But then he went on to do E.T., but he does credit Close Encounters and Carlo Rimbaldi, by the ways, who did the alien at the end, who did the hand signal.
The puppeteering.
Which is an actual hand signal thing for the thing. And he did the puppeteering and he made the facial things. And Spielberg looked at that alien, and that was his genesis of an idea. And again, it was born out of his parents' divorce, imaginary friends, E.T., coming down, and it was an alien. And Carlo Rimbaldi went on to create E.T. He made that creature. He also did King Kong, the Dino De Laurentiis version, which came out, I believe, of the same year, 77 or 78. With Jeff Bridges. So Carlo Rimbaldi was very integral. Obviously, to Close Encounters, Spielberg also had something else that was very interesting. If you noticed, all the aliens looked different. They weren't the same.
Right.
Right? First, you had the spider creature, which I was thinking about you. Because I was like going, is she going to get grossed out by this? But yeah like the
lanky arms, down. That was bad for me.
And then you had the little... kids. The little kids, and they were actually dance troops.
But I remember watching them. I was like, oh, they're so cute.
The kids. And then you had the puppeteer, but they all looked different. And Spielberg's rationale, catch about how forward-thinking he is. He goes, well, we're here on Earth, and we all look different. Why should we assume that they're not going to look different?
Yeah,
that they're going to look all the same? They're going to have different races, and they're going to look different. And I was like,
very true.
That's sort of kind of forward-thinking when you break that down.
Like, because, you're right.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to have my aliens look all differently. And even E.T. doesn't even look like there are similarities. But, one more thing about little Barry and Carrie. At the very end of the movie when he comes off the ship, he was wearing ballet slippers, and he was afraid he was going to slip and fall, and he was very embarrassed to wear ballet slippers. But when he gets picked up by Jillian... And he goes, are they leaving? And she goes, yeah. And he starts to cry. When he said, are they leaving? He meant, are we done filming the movie? And when she said, yes, he thought, oh, this is the end. He goes, I'm not going to see my friends anymore. So he really started to cry. And then Melinda Dillon really started to cry. And everybody filming it was crying because the little boy was, he's like, bye. He's like, bye. And that to me is like the cutest story.
Right.
And that kid, I don't know if he ever did another movie again, but he takes working on this. If you see interviews with him, he's so proud that he had this moment. And he tells great stories. ones that I recounted here. So you should go try to seek those out. You might find them on YouTube or the new Blu-ray release of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So
there you go.
Yeah. So all there right. you go. I hope everybody enjoyed, and hope if anything inspired you to maybe now watch the movie if you haven't already, or to revisit it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that we did a retro movie, because it's been a long time since we've done one of those.
And the time fit, because there's nothing that's come out the past couple of weeks.
I know. So we're filling in the gaps, yeah. so to speak.
And this movie was re-released for a reason, and I think it's a good reason. I wish we would do it more. I wish it made more money at this re-release, because I think there were so many movies that audiences, including myself, should be able to experience on a big screen, mm-hmm. because that's what really makes it special. So,
great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, yeah. for tuning in.
Where can
watching
everybody find
us.
You?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. Yes, television. And you can follow all of us here, Popcorn Talk, at The Popcorn yeah. Talk on all social medias. Our particular handle is at Movie Anatomy. We dissect movies every week.
Every week.
A lot of movies to talk about, and we can even go back to movies like this.
Yeah.
So where can we follow
and,
you?
Yeah, and I'm on, please support me on Twitter at DMovies. 1701. That's at DMovies 1701. Oh, there was a Star Wars reference in Close Encounters that we didn't get to. Did you notice it? At the bottom of the mothership, as it's going over Melinda Dillon's character, she looks up, there's a little R2-D2.
Oh.
Hanging upside down.
Nah.
On the mothership. She's still on the mountain.
I think I was blinded by the bright lights on the platform, so we'll see.
He just loved putting things... Oh, Star Trek was also in the movie. Did you see that?
Nope.
It was hanging in the boys' room. They had the Enterprise and a Klingon cruiser.
Oh, I saw the Enterprise. Hanging. Yeah, because yep. even I said out loud, I was like, that's the Enterprise. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So
I noticed that.
Last tidbits before we... before we go off into the sunset ourselves and get onto the big mother ship.
Yep.
Folks, please continue to join us. We'll be talking about It later on, which I can't wait to talk about that.
2017. See, the cool thing about this one, the Stephen King's original one came out in 1990. Yeah. It comes back every 27 years.
Yeah.
27 years later is 2017.
You're talking the miniseries.
It is coming out.
It. Yeah.
It. So you have that to look forward to.
Can't wait to talk about that
next
one.
Anatomy. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you all.
We'll see you next
Take
time.
Care. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.